Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
When the cost of living rises, how you invest matters even more. A financial advisor can help you make sense of it all. Now's the time to invest with advice. Visit dynamic.ca/advice to learn more.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 21st of June, these are our main stories. The US Coast Guard says the search for the missing Titanic submersible has still not yielded any results, and those on board have a dwindling supply of oxygen. Reports from Honduras say a riot and a fire to women's prison has left dozens dead. Also,
we won't be able to sustain this. Spring brought no rain, the wells have no water, meadows are dry. It should still be green, but it's all dry. This will kill us.
We have a special report on the crippling effects of drought in Portugal. Plus, in this podcast, four Israelis have been shot dead in the occupied West Bank in what the government has described as a terror attack. And Elton John speaks to the BBC as he prepares for his last ever concert in the UK at the world-famous Glastonbury Festival. Search and rescue teams are in a race against time to try to find the submersible that disappeared shortly after it began its descent to the wreck of the Titanic deep down in the northern Atlantic Ocean on Sunday. There are five people on board and only a limited supply of oxygen. In its latest update, Captain Jamie Frederick from the US Coast Guard, which is leading the search, gave this update on Tuesday afternoon.
We know from the data we were using as a starting point was 96 hours. We know at this point we're approximately, there's about 40 hours of breathable air. Based on that initial report, again, we're based on 96 hours when the vessel...
Captain Frederick told reporters there's a huge effort underway to get heavy equipment to the search site as early as possible.
Unified Command is working through that to prioritize what equipment we can get there. There are ongoing operations right now via the U.S. Navy and Transcom to get equipment, to get it on scene. I can't give you an exact timeline of when that's going to happen. Some of the equipment that's coming is coming from the East Coast, but again, we're talking about very heavy equipment. It's a complicated transport operation, but the best professionals in the world are working it, and that's U.S. Transcom.
The BBC's Nadine Youssef is in St. John's in Newfoundland, Canada, and sent us this update.
There's obviously some vessels around the ship that sort of served as the mothership of this submersible that are conducting just some search on the surface of the water. But they've also just brought in a cable-laying ship today that has deeper reach into the ocean than most vessels to try to reach as far down as possible to see if they can locate the submersible. There's also aircrafts from above that are monitoring the waters by sight and also by radar to see if they can locate anything. It's honestly a very foggy day today. It's very rainy. We flew out here yesterday and the weather was sort of a hindrance. Our flight was delayed. Some of our other correspondents have arrived here today. And again, the weather was a bit of a hindrance. And so it's not ideal conditions. You know, the submersible was aboard a icebreaker ship that was on its way to the wreckage site of the Titanic. And it's estimated that the wreckage site itself is about 13,000 feet deep below the Atlantic on the ocean bed. Authorities don't really know exactly where the submersible is, whether it's down, whether it's somewhere in the middle, whether it's on the surface, you know, it's yet to be seen. Hamish Harding, he's a British businessman and adventurer. He holds actually 3 Guinness World Records, which includes the longest time spent at full ocean depth during a dive in the deepest part of the Mariana Trench. We also have 2 other British nationals, a father and a son, Shahzada and Suleiman Dawood, from one of Pakistan's richest families. We also know there's Paul Henry Nariolet. He's a former French Navy diver who is also an expert on the Titanic. OceanGate, which is the company that spearheaded the trip, confirmed earlier today that its CEO is in fact on board the submersible as well. So those are the 5 people that are on board.
Next, with her assessment of the scale and complexity of such an unprecedented rescue operation, is our science correspondent, Victoria Gill.
It's still not known what happened to cause the OceanGate Titan submersible to lose communication. Professor Eric Fusil, a submarine engineer from the University of Adelaide, says the most optimistic scenario is that something happened to cut off Titan's communications, but that the vessel was able to return to the surface.
If there is a heavy sea and some swell, it would be quite hard to spot. Let's hope for the best. If that were the case, we could assume that a maritime patrol aircraft sweeping the area would detect something, either with radar, optical means, or infrared camera.
Although small, the sub weighs about 10 tons. And one major concern is that if it was swept too close to the unstable wreck of the Titanic during the dive, it could be trapped there. But Frank Owen, a former submarine search and rescue project director, said that finding and freeing the vessel, if it is stuck, will take time.
If it's not got that buoyancy, then it's being trapped in some way. It's got caught in some obstacle and it needs to get dislodged. I've got a timeline running. There's an awful lot to do. It's just starting to add up.
If it is able to locate the submersible, any remotely operated rescue sub might need to cut away whatever has trapped it or even add ballast to refloat the sub. But technical plans for any rescue mission are speculative, while a complicated search is still underway.
Victoria Gill. The sub lost at sea is only 6.7 metres in length, and with five on board, it'll be a very confined space. So, what could this nightmare scenario be like? Evan Davis spoke to an American journalist who has himself been down to the depths of the ocean to see the Titanic in a trip that did not go smoothly. Dr. Michael Guillen was the science editor at the American news network ABC.
I was the first correspondent ever to report from the wreck of the Titanic, so naturally I was excited. But once we got down there, we went from the bow of the ship towards the stern. When the ship sank, it first broke in two like a Christmas cracker. The bow went straight down, and then the stern did a kind of a somersault and ended up some distance away from the bow, settled down at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean. So we had already toured the bow. Everything had gone well. As we approached the stern area, flying over what's called the debris field, very moving experience. We didn't realize at the time, we found this out later, but we got caught in a very fast-moving underwater current. So we ended up getting stuck in the propeller.
This is the enormous Titanic propeller you got stuck in.
Huge. And then all of a sudden, there was this crash that we just felt this collision. Huge chunks, rusted chunks of the Titanic started falling on top of us. Now, I was looking through a very small porthole, maybe no more than I would estimate about 8 inches across. You understand I'm on my belly. It's very tight quarters in there. It's a three-man sub. You have the pilot in the middle, me, and then my diving buddy, Brian Cook. And then it was pretty clear to us that almost immediately we were stuck. And I say that because we knew our pilot, Victor, a former Russian MiG pilot, he was trying to jostle it out. You know, it's like when you get your car or truck stuck in the mud, you try to go forward, backward, just to try to dislodge yourself. And we all kind of fell silent because we didn't want to disturb, distract. We knew we were in a crisis, so we just kept quiet.
How did it get free?
It's through the skill of Victor. I mean, we were just fortunate. It was a better part of an hour. We were stuck, and I already pretty much had said my goodbyes. In my mind, and I'll never forget, this quote came into my head, this is how it's going to end for you. And then I thought of my, at that time, fiance, Laurel, and just said my goodbyes. And after about the better part of an hour, we sensed that something changed. We went from where the engine of the ship was trying to get us out. There was quiet. And there was a sense that we were floating, but we were in the dark. He had turned off the spotlight at that point. We didn't want to say anything. My gosh, is it possible that we're out of this? And I kept quiet for a moment. Then I turned to Victor and I said, okay. And I'll never forget, he said this in a very low, kind of growling, Russian accented voice. No problem. We all just, breathed a sigh of relief.
And, I bet.
But it took us 2.5 hours to go back up. It was pretty something.
Dr. Michael Guillen speaking there. To Evan Davis. At least 41 people have been killed in a prison riot in the Honduran capital, Tegucigalpa. According to officials, a fire was deliberately started, causing the majority of the deaths. Honduras, along with neighbours El Salvador and Guatemala, is a major transit route for cocaine coming from South America to the US. And that's seen violence soar in the region in recent years. Our Latin America correspondent, Katie Watson, has more details.
Videos posted on social media show a huge cloud of grey smoke rising from the women's prison just outside the Honduran capital. It's understood that a fight broke out between rival gangs after which one gang set fire to the cell of another. The prison facility holds around 900 inmates, many of the victims burnt to death. Others were shot, while some were taken to hospital for treatment. Honduras has a history of deadly prison riots, and it's known for its corruption and gang violence that's infiltrated government institutions and seen the homicide rate soar. But the country's deputy security minister, Julissa Villanueva, has declared a state of emergency and promised to crack down on the violence.
Katie Watson. Four Israelis have been shot dead and several others wounded in an attack near a settlement in the occupied West Bank. It follows heightened violence across the Palestinian territory in recent days. Israel's defense ministry has described the assault as a terror attack. Yolande Nel is our correspondent in Jerusalem.
Certainly, this looks like the most deadly attack targeting Israelis has been in several months. According to the Israeli military, two Palestinian gunmen opened fire at an Israeli petrol station and a hummus restaurant. They both lie on a busy main road that cuts right through the West Bank. Now, one gunman was shot by someone at the scene. The other one escaped and was tracked down and killed by Israeli special forces, apparently trying to make a getaway in a taxi. Reports say that both of these Palestinians, men in their early 20s, came from a village not far away to the north. They're said to have been affiliated with the Islamist militant group Hamas. And there has been comments from a spokesman from Hamas, not directly claiming responsibility for this attack, but saying that this was a response to what happened a day ago when six Palestinians were killed, dozens of people wounded in an Israeli military raid of Jenin that went on for many hours.
And what about Israel's reaction?
Well, now you have far-right Israeli ministers calling for a wider military operation. The Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is talking to members of the security forces. He has said that all options are open to respond. But meanwhile, we're seeing already some reports of Palestinian property being attacked by settlers, stones being thrown at cars. And it's just another reminder, if you look at the first half of this year, it's really been a deadly one. 27 people killed on the Israeli side, including one member of the security forces. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry, across the Palestinian territories, some 170 Palestinians killed by Israeli forces, by armed Israelis. So that number will include militants, but also civilians, especially in the West Bank, which has been really tense in the past few days, where there's been this heightened violence. This is really raising tensions, which were already running high, that much higher.
Yolande Nel. It's nothing new that summers in Portugal are pretty hot, but when temperatures rose to 36 degrees Celsius in April, one-third of the country was left in a state of severe drought even before summer arrived. The situation is at its worst in the regions of the Algarve and Alentejo, from where Antonio Fernandez now reports.
Not far from the Santa Clara Dam that feeds this part of Alentejo, I find Diogo Coutinho, the president of Project Earth, an organization that promotes development in the region. We met by the River Mira. Water should be flowing below us, but one side of the riverbed is completely dry.
This is where the situation is worst in Portugal. The Santa Clara Dam is only at 35% capacity and has been losing 6% a year. So if we're optimistic, we'll have water for another 3 years. Some people say even less.
Antonio Bernardino is a local farmer in the small town of Saboia. This year, the dam management only provided him with half the water he got last year.
We won't be able to sustain this. Spring brought no rain, the wells have no water, the meadows are dry. It should still be green, but it's all dry. This will kill us.
As Antonio calls the cattle out, it is evident that some are less well-fed than he desires.
The animals suffer and we suffer too. Seeing them without eating is like an illness for me.
Saboia's population has been shrinking. It's now only home to around 900 people, and many of them, like Antonio, rely on farming to survive. To keep the cattle fed, he has to turn to food supplements, but money is scarce, and Antonio's livelihood is threatened.
If I run out of money, I'll have to sell the cattle on the cheap. Sheep and lamb have no value now because everyone is selling. Someone that lives from farming here doesn't stand a chance.
But climate change is not solely to blame.
In the last few years, there's been an exponential growth in intensive farming that relies on water.
That's Diogo Coutinho from Project Earth.
These multinational companies come from from places like Spain and California, where resources are disappearing, where lakes and rivers are drying. And they come here to do the same, using a lot of water in land where there's no water. It's an industry that mostly exports, and most fruits are 80 or 90% water. So what we're doing is exporting water to countries that have plenty of water.
On top of that, 40% of the dam water ends up being wasted. Sara Correia, an environmental engineer with the Portuguese ONG Zero, says it's not a one-off.
There's districts where water waste reaches 80%, both in urban areas and for agriculture. With the drought, there was a race among farmers to drill boreholes into the ground, most of them illegal, and the Portuguese Agency for the Environment can control that. It doesn't know how many there are, where they are, and how much water they're capturing.
In April alone, the country faced three heat waves. The government has now put a stop to new licenses for irrigation cultures in the south of the country, as well as starting projects to capture more water. For Sara Correia and Diogo Coutinho, that's not the way to go.
They are always promoting measures to identify new ways to exploit the sources of water, when we should be working on reusing water.
I think solutions being brought forward now, like desalination, are just pushing the problem forward. I'd rather see solutions like reforestation. Let's create conditions so that there's more humidity on the land that will lead to more rain. Droughts are getting longer and longer. Without water, it won't be possible to live here.
As I drove away, I passed by an entire field of recently planted eucalyptus, trees that drain the soil of water.
Antonio Fernandez reporting from Portugal. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
The 100 metres came on and I think it was running like 11.3. And my best friend turns over to me and he says, I reckon you could put a pair of spikes on and beat these guys. He said, why have you never tried this? I didn't have an answer for him. And I said, OK, you know what? Let's give it a go.
Accountant by day and record-breaking sprinter in his spare time. We hear the remarkable story of Eugene Amodadze. Welcome back. There's a growing row in Italy over a prosecutor's decision to contest the birth certificate of a five-year-old girl. The document lists both her lesbian parents as her mothers, and the official in Padua says that is illegal. Our Europe editor, Danny Eberhard, told me more.
The acting prosecutor in Padua says that basically, according to the decisions of the Supreme Court in Italy, it's illegal to list two mothers on a birth certificate. So she is contesting this certificate, but she's also contesting more than 30 others of children who have two mothers listed on their birth certificate. So this is the first one. The child, as far as we know, is 5 years old. What the prosecutor is asking for a court is that the non-biological mother's name is removed from the birth certificate, and also that the child's own surname, she currently has both mother's surnames, like a double barrel surname, the non-biological mother's surname is removed. Now, this has outraged the mothers. The biological mother says that what you're doing is changing the child's identity. The child has just recently started the process of being enrolled for primary school. And if that decision is carried out by the courts, it would effectively strip the other mother from the child in terms of formal links. And also, the biological mother says, would also strip her direct connection with her brother. Now, the brother was born to the second parent. So it's a very interesting case. And obviously, human rights groups and particularly gay rights groups are outraged by this.
The top court in the European Union has ordered that all 27 countries in the bloc, which of course includes Italy, must recognise same-sex couples and their families. So this is going against that, isn't it? Even though Italy is part of the EU, of course.
Yeah, in Italy, obviously, there's a right-wing government in power. It's made an issue of some aspects of same-sex parenting rights. There is an earlier law in Italy that prohibited non-heterosexual couples from getting access to fertility treatment and surrogacy. And it's using these laws as a way of clamping down nationally on the idea of giving birth certificates to same-sex couples. Previously, it was more of a local decision, but gay rights groups say that the government of Giorgia Meloni is effectively pursuing a witch hunt against them. And for ideological ends, the government denies attacking the rights of same-sex couples.
Danny Eberhard. Glaciers are melting at unprecedented rates across the Hindu Kush Himalayan mountain ranges. They could lose up to 80% of their volume this century if greenhouse gas emissions aren't sharply reduced. The impact of this is already profound for the people who live in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Bhutan, China, India, Myanmar, Bangladesh and Nepal. Raza Iqbal spoke to Amina Maharajan from the International Centre for Integrated Mountain Development, an organisation which has conducted a report on the problem. And first, on the impact on agriculture.
70% of the population in the HKS region, and it is housed to 240 million people, depend on agriculture as main source of livelihood. Now, in the report, we have tried to put from smaller changes impacts to more extreme cases. In smaller impact, for instance, in high altitudes, snowfall is very, very important. If timely snowfall is not there, it's going to impact your crops. But there has been cases, for instance, in Pakistan, where glacier-fed irrigation system is so critical for farming. And when the glaciers start to melt and move up, then the irrigation systems are not functioning anymore. And people had to abandon their agriculture land.
There's also an impact on livestock as well.
Absolutely. On livestock, for instance, with this atmospheric changes, what we have seen is the biodiversity is changing, the diversity of pasture, these are also changing. And what we see is endemic species are getting low and more invasive species are crowding the pasture land. And that has an impact on the fodder that the yaks and sheep actually depend on. We also see extreme cases. For instance, in Langtang village in Nepal, there was this long snowfall period, a long period of time, and that led to starvation that, like hundreds of yak dying in one season alone.
And the Hindu Kush, of course, for those who have been there, is very, very beautiful, and tourism is a big part of the economy. Mm-hmm. How is that being affected?
Tourism is also being impacted because people come here to experience that clear blue sky, white glistening mountains. But then like with the kind of climate change induced weather systems, there is no trekking season per se. So in October, September, you expect really clear weather to be there. But then suddenly you realize it's not that. April is a good trekking season. But now we are having snowfalls in April. And that disrupts the experience of the tourist, but also the risk for the tourists as well as the guides.
How would you characterize the way in which communities are able to adapt to these changes?
Good news, people are not sitting idle, so they are doing whatever they can to cope with these changes. But not so good news is what we captured in our study. There is really very little planned state-supported adaptation actions happening.
And in your view, the mitigation has to come from elsewhere.
Exactly. Irrigation is critically important because we cannot continue to function with these unlimited emissions. And that's a global responsibility. But what is fascinating is when we are visiting the communities, I get this question increasingly, what can we do to mitigate? And then I have to tell them that there is nothing that you can do. What you need to focus is on how do you adapt to these changes, because some of these changes are irreversible. Glaciers that is gone is gone.
Amina Maharajan speaking to Razia Iqbal. The Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi has arrived in the US on a 3-day official visit, described as a turning point in bilateral relations. He and President Biden are expected to discuss defence cooperation and the sharing of technology. With more details, here's our South Asia editor Anbalasan Etharajan.
Mr. Modi has visited the US 5 times since becoming Prime Minister in 2014, but this will be his first state visit. President Biden will host a dinner in his honor. Delhi is keen to get the latest American weapons, such as drones, and to co-produce jet engines in India. Washington hopes that a stronger India will be a partner in counterbalancing China's influence worldwide. But Mr. Modi's visit is not without controversy. 75 Democratic congressmen have urged President Biden to raise human rights issues. They have highlighted the shrinking of political space in India, the rise of religious intolerance, restrictions on press freedom and the targeting of civil society.
And Barasan Etharajan. By day, Eugene Amodadze is an accountant for a property firm. In his spare time, he's one of the fastest sprinters in the world. Amodadze has just run 100 metres in under 10 seconds, making him the fourth fastest Briton of all time and the quickest in Europe this year. And what's truly startling is that he only started taking running seriously a few years ago. He told James Menendez about the moment he crossed the finish line in under 10 seconds.
I mean, it was such a surreal feeling, like, immediately I cross the line and I look over and I see 9. I just went absolutely crazy. Like, I literally just went crazy. I was jumping up and down, running around, and didn't really know what to do with myself in the immediate moment.
Tell us, though, about the story, because it is an unusual one. I think you only really started athletics properly, at the age of 26. How did that come about then?
So, honestly, such an interesting story. I was with one of my best friends and we used to play football, and we played at a local league in London, and we were at an athletics track in London playing a pre-season game, and we were on our way home. As we was on our way home, we saw that there was a local athletics meeting going on. So we thought, we're athletics fans. It doesn't matter if it's a World Champs or a local meeting, we're going to watch. So we sat down and watched it. The 100 metres came on and I think it was running like 11.3. And my best friend turns over to me and he says, I reckon you could put a pair of spikes on and beat these guys. And then he asked me the question. He said, why have you never tried this? Like, he was fast at school, and my best friends had always made fun of me for years. Oh, we had your talent, what we would have done. And I guess for a long time, it was enough for me to believe that I could have done it. Oh, yeah, those guys that said, oh, if I didn't blow out my knee, I could have been a professional footballer. I guess I was that guy with track and field. And I didn't have an answer for him. And I said, OK, you know what? Let's give it a go. Let's try. And that's how I started.
Because you did do a bit of athletics at school, didn't you? But why didn't you take your talent seriously and pursue it? Were you just not that interested?
I come from a West African background. My parents came to the UK from Ghana. And as much as they would be really, really happy for me if I'd come home and tell them I'd won a medal and things like that, for them, it was very much focus on your studies. Get a qualification, become a doctor, become an engineer, become an accountant, become a lawyer. So for me, athletics was something that I could just have fun, just enjoy, without the pressure of having to make it into something. So I was the classic boy who grew up wanting to become a footballer. So if you'd said, yeah, I could become a footballer, I probably would have begged my parents to let me do it. But yeah, track and field was just something that I really loved to do and just have fun with, really.
Incidentally, what were you like when you were playing football for your local team? I mean, were you just running past everyone?
I can imagine, yeah. Look, I can say I've never met anyone on a football pitch that could keep up with me. And, they're knocking balls over the top and you're tapping them in. So, yeah, it was fun times.
You're a full-time accountant, but you're pursuing the athletics in the best way that you can. But you're doing without sponsors or funding. How hard is that?
I try not to look at those things as things to hold me back, but rather a challenge to accept and hopefully show people that you're never too old or you're not too busy, or what you may perceive to be something that may potentially hold you back, actually, you can flip it on its head and use it as something that actually sets you apart from everybody else. Saying that, your Nikes, your Adidas's, your Asics, your New Balances, your Pumas, give me a shout. Let's work.
I mean, they've got to be paying attention, haven't they? Well, perhaps they will now once they've heard this.
I hope so.
And I think there are only, three British men who have ever been faster than you?
That's right. Linford Christie has the British record at 9.87. And James DeSalu and Zarnell Hughes have both run 9.91. And then comes myself and Reece Prescott tied at 9.93. I have aspirations in terms of there's a World Championships in August. So I would love to get my first senior outdoor vest. I got my first indoor vest at the European Championships in Istanbul in March. But I'd love to get my first GB outdoor vest at those championships in Budapest, the World Championships.
Eugene Amodadze talking there to James Menendez. And finally, he has sold more than 300 million records worldwide, making this pop star one of the best-selling music artists of all time. He is the British music legend, Elton John. In a career spanning 50 years, Elton John has worked with some of the biggest names in music. You heard him there with Kiki Dee, Little Richard and George Michael, but his recent chart successes have been with Dua Lipa and Britney Spears. This weekend, Elton John will headline the famous Glastonbury Music Festival for the first time in what is his last ever concert here in the UK. And he's promising a brand new show and surprise guest artists. Sir Elton's been speaking to BBC Radio 1's Clara Amfo about his collaborations and whether he ever reaches out to other artists.
I wait for a call.
Right.
And you run into people. I said, a lot of people are afraid of asking me to play on the record, but I've just come full circle. That's what I used to do before I became Elton John. I love it so much. When I did the lockdown sessions, I was in Abbey Road doing an interview for the documentary. We did an interview and I said, you know, it's so funny. I'm going down to Studio 2 now to put my voice on a Glen Campbell track. You're never gonna see it in my eyes. And to play on Little Nas X, right? I like this, I don't like that. Do this here, don't you do that. And I said, it was the same studio that I recorded in, that I did the Hollies record, He Ain't Heavy, He's My Brother. Same staircase, same old desk with the padding sticking out. All I know. And I said, it just feels so good, you know. I love playing on people's records. And when they ask me, I always say, yeah, why not?
Well, I guess that's the thing, isn't it? I think a true love of music almost has no ego, right?
Well, I went one day in LA. I went and played and sang on an Engelbert Humperdinck record because he wrote me the sweetest letter. And I thought, how can I say no to this man? And it was just the best. So I went to his studio. And I can't explain. Did my thing with him, went down the road for about half a mile, and I played on Queens of the Stone Age the same day.
Sure.
So why? Why not?
Why not?
It was just, you know, that's what I love. I'm not a snob. And if people are nice, I'll do anything for them, yeah.
In future, are you going to be doing more collaborations like how you did with Dua or with Britney? Are you going to just try and keep that in a moment in itself?
They came up just as a spur of the moment thing, especially the Cold Heart thing. I don't know. Who knows? They were unplanned and they did really well. And I enjoy them. I like doing one-off things, but I'm not going to plan to do them because I think that's boring. If they come up, they'll come up. And if I like it, I'll do it. But I like the dance tracks, you know, because I don't normally do things like that. I'm game for anything.
The one and only Elton John speaking there to Clara Amfo. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Emma Joseph. The editor, as ever, is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.
When the cost of living rises, how you invest matters even more. A financial advisor can help you make sense of it all. Now's the time to invest with advice. Visit dynamic.ca/advice to learn more.